You're here with Carrie Willard at Natural Moms Talk Radio, and we are joined this week by Katie from AlignedAndWell.com. Good morning, Katie.
Good morning.
I'm so excited to be talking with you. I've become a huge fan of your philosophies and blog, and I have like three of your exercise DVDs, and so I have some questions.
Yeah. Go for it.
It's funny how sometimes you just happen upon something on the internet and you don't really know how you got there or, you know, what little rabbit trail you followed. I don't remember how I found out about your website, but when I did, I just started digging in and reading archives and searching, you know, various things, and I was like, oh my gosh, this is really awesome. It makes a lot of sense. So please tell us more about yourself and your background and what you are all about.
Well, I'm a biomechanical scientist. So biomechanics is the science, the physics of biology, I guess is the easiest way to say it. And excuse me, I think I was just going to sneeze for a second. And I apply, my specialty is applying the field of biomechanics to injury and disease. And I've always been most interested in where disease comes from, the mechanisms, like the actual cause. More so, I don't think there's a lot of work being done to try to find cause as much as there's a lot of work trying to take care of the problem, but like an engineer will usually figure out what the problem is before trying to find the solution. So it's a lot easier to reverse engineer something than it is to kind of stab in the dark to make a solution. So I've always had that natural interest, but I've always come from a platform regarding the human from its original state, not the modern human, because the modern human, which is, you know, not just the human living in the 21st or 22nd century, but really the human as it's lived since humans were. So your earliest humans before there were cars and before there was abundant food, even agriculture. That population had all the same equipment. We have all the same equipment, but the habits are different. So I've always kind of investigated how do the habits of modern living contribute to a set of diseases that we call affluent ailments. So affluent ailments are all the stuff that you will likely have and that your parents have and that your friends have. And they're very normal. They've become very common within our population, but it's always important to kind of maintain the perspective of they're still diseases and injuries based on the way we live. They're not genetic issues, and they're certainly preventable if you know enough information and, you know, can change large components of the way you live. And you don't have to give up your house and give up your food, but, you know, for example, just not sitting as much in chairs makes a big difference. And then I would say that my focus has really become the pelvis, pelvic floor disorder. Female pelvic floor disorder was my specialty in graduate school. It's what I did all my research and my thesis on. So probably how you stumbled to the blog was probably through something related to pregnancy or pelvic floor disorder, because even though I do the whole body, it seems like that's where most people who are readers of the blog and users of the material, that's where people are coming from. They're coming to fix something to do with their pelvis or their abdomen, and it's usually pregnancy-related, so we have a lot more women who are interested. So that's also, it's also my greatest love. I'm a woman. I'm a woman who's currently pregnant. I just had a baby, but even, you know, 10, 15 years before that, I was still kind of interested in the pelvis. So that's probably me in a nutshell.
Cool. You know, it just came to me. I think how I found you was doing some Googling about plantar fasciitis, because my husband started to develop symptoms of that, and I was like, what in the heck is that? I mean, when I had heard of that in years past, it was like something that elderly people had, you know?
Right.
And I was like, what the heck? And I think that's maybe how I found your blog, but I did come across some articles on other blogs that, you know, interviews you had done, information that people had found you about pelvic floor issues. And I've kind of been lucky in that area, I guess. I mean, this is my sixth pregnancy, but I've not really had the quote, you know, the classic pelvic floor issues a lot of women have had in their pregnancy. So maybe I accidentally did some things right.
Yay. Thanks.
But we are going to talk, you know, a lot about pregnancy because, you know, this is my show and I'm selfish and I can ask you some questions that will help me right now. But, yeah, I had emailed you a few questions and you mentioned things like, you know, sitting in chairs and stuff like that, which, again, about 14 years ago when I was pregnant with my first child and I took, you know, Bradley husband coach childbirth classes, there was a lot of instruction about tailor sitting, you know, on the floor and, you know, staying out of couches and things like that. And that's something that I've always kept in mind. And this pregnancy has really been the most comfortable that my back and hips have ever been. And I have not had the pelvic pain. And I think it's because I have tried really hard to stay out of chairs and do more walking and things. So what are some things other than that that pregnant women should be doing to kind of prevent those aches and pains that we hear so much about and also to prepare for labor to have an easier delivery?
Well, I think I always like to start off any pregnancy conversation with just kind of getting the mindset that pain and pregnancy should not go together. Again, it's become really culturally common, but pregnancy should not be a pain, I guess is the easiest title to give it. And that the pains that we have in the low back and the hips and the ligaments and the knees and the feet really have more to do with the fact that we're pretty deconditioned as humans. And this goes for even, you know, people who exercise every single day. We're still fairly inert for as a group of people. We don't move very much. And when we do, it's always kind of the same way. So if women can begin to get some of their strength before becoming pregnant, that would be most ideal, meaning that keeping yourself strong enough to deal with, you're going to have an extra, you know, somewhere between 20 and 40 pounds or more that's going to go on your frame. And so alignment, which is kind of the term I use a lot, has to do with the way that all of your bones are positioned relative to each other. So there's an alignment to the skeleton that can hold the weight very comfortably without requiring joints to collapse or ligaments to strain. And that you get a lot of muscular development in response to this extra load. So being concerned or kind of learning what alignment is better, obviously, I mean, if you can imagine trying to stack a pile of books onto a table that's well-balanced, the books are just going to sit up there and it's going to be a nice, peaceful situation for the books and the table. But if the table has, you know, one leg that's a little bit shorter or the top of the table is sitting slightly off, it might not have been a big deal. It might have been able to sit there in your living room as long as no one touched it, but as soon as you stack books on it, it begins to crumble. So you want to get to know the alignments in your body that will support the extra weight and start doing them as soon as you become pregnant. And the nice thing is you have a lot of months after becoming pregnant really where you really don't have that burden of extra weight yet. So you have, you know, I would say you can take your first 4 to 5 months to kind of start thinking about, and not just thinking, actually doing some of the stuff. And that would include usually muscle tensions are interfering with your strength. So feet, calves, hamstrings, these are the tight muscles that tend to pull the pelvis out of alignment. And so tucking the pelvis, which is something that a lot of people tend to do. If you're sitting down right now, chances are you're sitting with a tucked pelvis. One of the reasons Bradley probably had you come out of the chair, couches, because you kind of slouch in a couch, and so you end up having this pelvis that's tipped back, and the alignment of, you know, your uterus and your pelvis go hand in hand. So you want to keep all of those axes vertical. So stretching those muscles, and then, of course, not using the furniture that promotes slouchiness. Your floor is a great thing to transition to while you're pregnant. Even if you need to sit on a couple pillows, that's fine. It's having something behind your back that really allows you to kind of slouch. And then walking. You know, I think most people know enough basic exercise science to know that your muscles respond to what you're doing. So as you're getting more weight, as you're accumulating more mass on your body, it's important that you take that mass and walk around with it so that your legs and your abdominals and your pelvic floor and your back become stronger as you gain weight, so that the relationship between your weight and your strength is always even. You never have kind of large surges of weight gain during periods of inactivity. You know, if you're still working or sitting all day long, it's really kind of important that you take breaks, walking breaks throughout the day, so it's not, you know, if you gain 4 or 5 pounds over a period of a month but really only walked, you know, 1 or 2 days a week, you're going to find that your body rapidly becomes weaker than the weight. And then once you have that weakness and then the weight, then the weight begins to pull on various structures, and that's where the pain comes from. So stretching, walking, reducing your sitting time, and learning your alignment would probably be my basic essential list for pregnancy. And it will help with your delivery as well.
Okay, and I'll have you know that I'm sitting with my booty sticking out.
Oh, good.
So I'm doing good. Which is very difficult to do if you're sitting on a sofa. I mean, it's nearly impossible, I find. So, you know, I've been trying to get on the floor a lot with my toddler. And really the only time that I sit during the day for a long period would be if I'm sitting and writing. You know, I might sit for an hour. But I've been putting my computer on the kitchen counter, mm-hmm. and, you know, kind of... When you stand, you're never still. You know, I'm wiggling, I'm kind of switching back and forth, I'm putting my elbows, you know, on the counter and kind of letting my belly hang and stuff. So it's kind of like that keeps you moving a little bit, because I get so uncomfortable when I'm sitting.
Yeah, standing workstation. And you don't have to go buy a standing workstation. Like you said, just put your computer up on the counter for even a little fraction of the time that you're working. Get a crate or get a box and, you know, move your keyboard up, do something, because they now realize that sitting is the greatest risk factor for death, more so than smoking, more so than being completely sedentary, and more so than diet. So you can have a good diet, you can be a regular exerciser, and you can not smoke, and you're going to still have that same health profile as the person who smoked if you're a sitter. You know, it's really crazy
right.
to go, wow. and that's good to know, because it was starting to look kind of disheartening about why people who spend all this time being healthy aren't mitigating any of the, like, they're still getting the same amount of diseases, the same amount of surgery. So it's nice to have the understanding, like, oh, it's the sitting that's not working for the human body.
Right. Yeah, we're just not made to sit for hours a day. And, you know, I can watch my children, and they don't sit for long periods of time, you know, especially toddlers and preschoolers. I mean, they're always on the move. And if they're on the floor, they're squatting or, you know, just constantly wiggling around. And so really, I think if we just were to watch the average two-year-old, we'd probably, and do what they do, you know, we'd be a lot better off.
And give them a break, because, I mean, what we're trying to make them like us, you know, like, can you please sit still, instead of recognizing that most people struggle for the rest of their life with excessive stillness,
right.
and then, you know, they're trying to do all this stuff, and it's like, if you really recognize, like, oh, that's what's happening, is it's easier to watch a kid that is still because we're still, and just use them as natural training mechanisms, going, I'm going to let them teach me, because they know.
Yeah.
They know how to stay healthy.
Yeah, like when I watch my 21-month-old do a squat, I'm like, oh, my gosh, look at, and I'm always pointing at my husband. He probably thinks I'm weird. I'm like, look at her. Her knees don't come past the tips of her toes. Her shins are straight up and down. Look at that.
I know.
It's really cool.
Amazing.
So I read on your blog in several places that holding in your stomach, you know, like to appear skinny and stuff, is a bad idea because it increases the pressure, you know, in your abdomen and can lead to other problems. And I have been doing that for years, and it's so unconscious that even now, I'm like 27 weeks pregnant, I find that I'm still doing it, and I have to, like, release it all the time, over and over and over. I'm constantly checking it. Do you have any suggestions on how to let go of that?
It's, you know, and it's not just you. I would say that everyone, almost everyone, has been doing it for so long where it's nothing that they even have to think about anymore. It's really become part of just their natural way that they carry themselves. You're doing the right thing, which is just release it as often as you can, because I think to understand that when I'm talking about sucking, when people suck your stomach in, like if you were standing without your shirt on and someone's going to take a picture of you in your bathing suit, you know, your reflex position of pulling it in is what most people do all the time. And it's not, you're not firing your abdominal muscles. You're actually lifting your diaphragm up in your body, so it puts a lot of pressure on your lungs. It kind of jams your lungs and your heart up, which is why that's one of the reasons I have people stop, is because it's kind of the mechanism for hiatal hernias and hernias that people get down the road. And then it's also, of course, a core weakening thing to do because you've turned off the stomach muscles. So then you'll find you'll have to do it more and more, and then you begin to accumulate mass on your waist because those muscles are off over a long period of time. So you will end up, if you relax it, getting the core strength and the core appearance that you want. So that can be kind of your goal at the end, going, if I can relax this enough, I'll actually have more of the abdominals that I covet or desire. But if people have a good association visually as a reminder, like you're reminding yourself as often as you think about it, so you're going to only release it as much as your mind kind of reminds you. But if you get something like a sticker, I like big smiley stickers or something like a big red dot, and you put three or four dots in the areas where you spend most of your time. So one on your steering wheel.
The kitchen.
One in front of the dishes, if you're me. One on my laptop, you know, in the corner. You can figure out the places where you spend most of your time. And it just becomes a visual cue it's an old psychology trick of just kind of helping remind you. You'll begin to associate seeing that dot with relaxation. And then if you're doing it often enough by frequenting those places, then you'll find that you're spending more time relaxed. And it's just a motor program. When you're reminding yourself, the good news is your brain is starting to interpret the behavior of sucking in your stomach as something undesirable and is just reminding you that you're doing it. So you're on the right path of reducing a habit. It just takes a while because you said it's been years. So, you know, habits sometimes can take a long time to break, especially when they're buried deep in our brain.
Yeah, I'm doing the same thing with, you know, my posture, making sure that my weight is back over my heels and that my head is not jutting forward and what's the other one? Tucking my pelvis. But the weird thing is that when I let go of the tension in my stomach and kind of let it hang, it's almost like it's hard to breathe. What's going on there?
Well, I mean, there can be multiple things. Your method or your mechanism of breathing varies. There's of course one way that we breathe naturally, and breathing is a muscular event that happens between the diaphragm and the ribs opening up individually. They kind of rotate, which kind of allows your rib cage to bellow open. If you ever watch a baby, how they breathe when they're sleeping and when they're standing, that's kind of, unless they've had some sort of birthing, you know, event or some sort of lung issue, they're breathing kind of in their natural motor programming. But your years of sucking in your stomach, like a lot of people, has caused you to, we call it in clinically, it's like a reverse breath. You've developed a whole different mechanism or motor program for breathing. So when you let your stomach out, your diaphragm goes back into its natural position and it simply does not know how to behave. You're unable now to recruit your old breathing mechanism. So what you would want to do is start to maybe do some conscious breathing as soon as you relax, or you can do some of your relaxation, probably not on your back. I don't know how comfortable you are on your back or how far along you are at this point, but you want to try to imagine taking a deep breath with your abdomen relaxed and lying down or propped up or whatever is most comfortable, and see if you can't find that natural breathing mechanism again. Because once you start interfering with one motor program, they all kind of start getting jumbled. So you fix one thing, and then you have to fix another thing, and you have to fix another thing, which is what makes alignment so much work.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense, because the feeling is similar to the sensation that you have after you give birth, you know, like that next few hours when you stand up. You feel like everything has fallen out and it's hard to remember how to breathe. That's how it feels. So that makes sense. Well, speaking of sucking your stomach, I mean, I'm as vain as the next gal, you know. I'm concerned about getting back into shape. I'm 37. This is my sixth pregnancy. What do you recommend for women to do to get their abs back into shape after the baby? Because, you know, we've kind of learned that crunches are not all that. They're not the be-all, end-all, you know, ab exercise. I think everybody knows that now. What do you recommend?
Well, you know, animals, besides us, don't spend very much time doing specific exercises to get tone. They just have tone. I mean, if you look at every other animal besides, you know, the ones that live with us, they have natural tone, and they have tone on four legs where it's a lot more work to get. So the biggest weakener, the biggest thing that most people are doing who are listening to this right now that makes their stomach muscles soft and not able to stabilize their body is lift the ribs. It's another one of those, you know, we suck the stomach in and then we tend to lift the chest,
yeah,
which
like
of course takes the rib
posture.
Yeah, the military, or if you took a lot of dance. So that chest lift, it actually pulls the rib cage away from the torso. And if you imagine doing a crunch, like if you just put, even if you just don't get on the floor, but just if you're standing there listening, if you put your hands behind your head and kind of mimic doing a crunch, and you bring your body forward or your ribs forward to the same position that you would normally on the floor, to where it would be like the top part of your crunch exercise, that's where the ribs go all of the time. And then, but the problem is when we're done with the exercise, we then lift the ribs back up away from the abdomen. But the stomach muscles, the muscles, not just the long up and down muscles, but the ones that come around our body, the ones that actually give you a waist, the ones that kind of compress the midsection, those all require your ribs being down in order to function all the time. So the only reason your stomach isn't where it should be is because the habitual position you put your body in turns off the stomach muscles. So just like letting your stomach go, if you can drop your ribs down and forward until they fit into their spot, you will notice kind of instantaneously, usually only takes a few days of keeping your ribs down, that you begin to have upper abdominal definition.
Wow.
And then, of course, as you know, as I'm done talking, we'll just notice that our ribs just start to go back up. We just tend to, it's another posture thing, right? Good posture is shoulders back, chest up. But then, of course, it leads to stomach weak and all the same issues that everyone who's been following those postural guidelines end up with. So ribs down, yeah. Ribs down, ribs down, ribs down. And don't tuck your pelvis. If you can keep your pelvis and your rib cage in alignment right over each other, they kind of like make a circle that stacks right on top of each other. And if you do that, your stomach muscles fire naturally. You shouldn't have to consciously fire your muscles. They should be doing it on their own.
I had to get rid of this exercise DVD because the trainer person was constantly saying to tuck your butt, tuck your butt, tuck your butt. And when I started, you know, devouring the content on your blog, I'm like, that's not right. That's not right. But why do we do that? Why is that like a common thing that women do, to tuck their butt under? Why do we do that?
I think it's been tracked pretty culturally. It really comes from the Victorian period of time. I mean, there was a really large puritanical surge within the United States. So, you know, when you have, you know, colonies who come over and they brought kind of the Victorian belief system from the British Isles, it was, you know, very much that modesty and straight lines were coveted and were more upper class. And then, you know, looking at populations of people who had curves, like if you had buttocks that were out, then that meant that you were lustful, and you know, it was kind of like a missionary standpoint. You know, if you've ever spent any time traveling to populations that have been heavily settled, that was one of the main things, like, you know, get yourself covered, become more modest, no more, you know, hula dancing was outlawed in the Polynesian Islands. You know, there's no more dancing, because moving your pelvis and circulating your body was, you know, essentially gyration and very sexual in nature. So we just kind of wanted to remove all of that because it was, you know, believed to be ungodlike behavior. And then, you know, all of us have grandmothers. I mean, that's not that long ago. I mean, it's only been in the last 400 or 500 years. But, you know, chances are your grandmother or your mother kind of imparted that information, you know, oh, don't stick your butt out. Or sometimes it's just as simple as a smaller butt or a smaller stomach is better because we believe it to be so. So if you can adjust your skeleton, I get a lot of emails from women who are like, you know, my mother or my father told me to stop standing. I looked sloppy when I stood, you know, where you could see buttocks and you could see abdominal flesh. And one woman, she's like, I actually remember the day my dad told me and showed me how to tuck so that I wouldn't walk around because he said I didn't look good. You know, there's so many messages like that, and that's really where it comes from. And then in terms of what you see on a DVD, when we started having group exercise classes, which really didn't start until the 80s, you know, with kind of like the whole aerobic.
Jane Fonda.
Yeah. You know, there was, people were trying to do, you know, you wanted to strengthen your butt, so you did 700 leg lifts. I mean, it was like really ridiculous how many repetitions they would do. And so people started hurting themselves, of course, because you're not really meant to do 100 of anything in a row. That's kind of at a weird angle. So then we started kind of telling teachers, well, to protect your back, you know, when you lie on your back, to protect your back, push your back down into the ground. You know, when you're playing sports, slightly bend your knees and tuck your pelvis to be in the ready position. So they're kind of sports cues that just got out of hand. They were kind of created by someone who was trying to make a quick fix of how can one person teach 40 people in a jazzercise class. And it just stuck. And then unfortunately what's happened is physical therapy has been more influenced by what's happening in the fitness realm than vice versa. You don't have a lot of fitness population because there's way more fitness and exercise teachers than there are physical therapists who have, you know, a lot more training. I mean, you're talking about having a master's degree in college as opposed to, you know, typically there's never a degree required for any sort of fitness or health certification. So you have a large mass of people who are actually teaching the exercise who don't have kind of the information. And then unfortunately, fitness has influenced more what physical therapists are starting to teach, which is I work with a lot of physical therapists in continuing education. And all we can track it to is fitness people tend to be very fit and fit looking. And so it just seems that people, like if you were going to go to a physical therapist or to a really great exercise instructor, the exercise instructor tends to look more fit. And so you just tend to want to follow that advice more because you want the end goal of looking a little bit better. And so now we've got all of these kind of pop cultural cues of Kegels all the time and, you know, put your low back down on the ground to protect your back and bend your knees when you come up so that you don't use your back. And like all these kind of sayings that no one really quite understands yet, they've become what we call a cultural meme, meaning that everyone kind of believes them. You could create a list of them. You do them, you follow them. You don't know why, because someone told you and you just do it. And then we teach our kids the same thing kind of without even realizing it. And then 200 years have gone by and everyone's walking around with bent knees and tucked pelvis and lift chest and then trying to do exercise to fix it.
Right, to give themselves a booty.
Yeah,
because I always wanted to have a booty, and I didn't have one until a few years ago when I started doing a little weightlifting, and the trainer taught me, you know, to stick my booty out when I did a squat.
Right.
And for the first time in my life, I had a booty, and I was so proud of that thing.
Yeah.
And it's really nice.
Yeah,
but,
and I mean, it's nice to look at, but even better than that, it's really nice structurally. You can't not have a butt. Like, you have to get a butt. If you do not have one, put it on your Christmas list.
Yes.
But this year, because it's really important to your back and your pelvic floor that you have one.
Yeah. And so I've been noticing a lot of that lately. Like, you know, like when I walk around and I see this attractive woman, she turns around and she's just got the wasted buttocks. I'm thinking, oh, it's so, yeah, bad.
It's atrophy. I mean, it's muscular atrophy is what you're seeing. Is
right.
All.
And she might have these incredible calves, but, you know, the booty is just wasted away to nothing, so that's not natural. Okay, so the postpartum belly wraps that have become really popular, you know, like the Kim Kardashian belly bandit, you know, $70, whatever. Now, when I started researching those with my last pregnancy, there seemed to be a lot of info that this was like an ancient cultural practice, and I thought, well, you know, maybe it has some merit. What's your thought about those?
Well, I mean, I think that something can be helpful. It doesn't have to mean that it's natural. for example, I mean, most people don't have any core strengths, and you're not going to suddenly, spontaneously develop core strengths right after you've given birth, which is when you really need it. So it's like a tool that helps you it's a tool that helps you in a situation when you're trying to get back up and up on your feet by providing the support that your muscles should be providing. Now, that all being said, there's a way to have all that. It's not a necessary biological thing. You shouldn't have to wrap back up. You should be able to get back up and immediately begin to recruit, although not with, you know, bodybuilder style right after you've given birth, but you shouldn't have lost your strength during pregnancy. But most people haven't lost it. They just never had it. They didn't have it before, they didn't have it during, and they didn't have it after, so they need something. So, you know, a wrap is a pretty minimally invasive, I mean, I guess maybe the expense being the only thing, and then you have to put it on. But I'm real cautious when it comes to things like wraps and braces and orthotics, et cetera, because they mask what the real issue is. So people then don't understand when a year later they have something that maybe they don't put two and two together that was a root cause of not actually having the strength at the time. So a wrap, you know, it's fine if you want to use it, but I'm always more of an advocate for get to know your body and the strength that it should have and do that kind of work, or at least know that that work is what you're supposed to be doing or what you should do and go, I just can't do it right now, and I'll put it on the list to do later. Because if not, it never gets on the list, and then all of a sudden years and years go by and you're sitting here with this list of diseases that you didn't have to have and that you had plenty of early warning signs that you were going to get if you continue to do the same things over and over again.
Gotcha. Okay, so let's talk real briefly about squatting, because you mentioned that a lot on your blog and the importance of, you know, grown-ups squatting, and if you can't squat, how you need to work on that. I've always known, you know, the importance of that, and I've always been kind of proud of the fact that I could get into a deep squat. I mean, like, my husband cannot, so I you know, like to kind of lord it over him that I can and he can't. But, you know, I don't feel so confident about myself, because I realize when I do it, I am tucking my butt under again by the time I get down low. So should I continue doing it that way so that my muscles loosen up, you know, and my hips and things, and I can eventually do it correctly with my booty out? Or should I work on more of those kind of pre-squat warm-ups that you talk about on your blog?
Well, I would say yes to all of it.
Okay.
You don't have to, I mean, if the reason that when your knees go forward, when you tuck your pelvis and your knees kind of go forward over your toes, all it means is that during that squat, you're using more your quadriceps and the front, the muscles on the front of your body, and not so much the muscles on the back of your body. So to say a squat, even semantically, is hard to compare, because you're really comparing an apple to an orange. When your pelvis is untucked when you're doing in a squat and your shins are vertical, then you're on the back side of your body, so you're getting more hamstring and more glute use. So the squat that you're doing in the process, you know, or as a process of transitioning, still has benefit. It's just that some people have already kind of worn through all the cartilage in their knees and their hips. So for them, I would say it's more important to just work on the squat prep and work on a shallower or more shallow squat, but keeping yourself entirely in the backside muscles. And so I think I posted a video of a modification where you're just coming up and down out of a chair.
Yeah, yeah.
But if your knees and hips are fine, a deep squat is no big deal, then you can do that. And then while you're down there, I also have a picture of, you know, holding onto a doorknob and working at untucking and seeing if you can come out of it, so being supported by something like your arm strength and a doorknob, where at least you're going to get some of more of the glute benefit. Although, you know, your joint range of motion is commendable, and having that joint range of motion for a long period of time will also keep your knees and hips much more supple, if especially if you've been doing it regularly throughout your life. So you still want to work on squat prep, because it still means that your hips aren't articulating as well as they could be, that your knees are kind of having to do more of the opening than your hips are. But it's all good. It's just a matter of, like, when you're prescribing something, like a behavior for someone, you have to kind of understand that everyone's at a different level. They've all been doing different. They're like a snowflake. They're a movement snowflake. And so blanket prescriptions really just don't work because someone will say, well, I can't do that, and then therefore won't really even kind of entertain the notion of you really can modify a squat, and you should. And then there's just also something like, you know, you can get a squat platform around your toilet where you don't have to do any muscular work, but you can just put your feet up on it while you're sitting in the bathroom. Then none of your muscles are really straining, but at least your joints are getting some opening benefit. So there's so many different ways that you can go about improving that no one is, not included in the conversation. Everyone can make improvement of their knees and their hips and their pelvic floor no matter where you are right now. You can always make a huge leap of improvement.
And I have one of those squatting platforms in my basement, and I'm going to bring it up this today. They are marketing it as like a toddler, you know, potty training thing, so they don't feel like they're going to fall backwards into the commode. You know, they have something to put their feet on. But I liked that thing, so
yeah,
I'm
going to
bring it up. I really love what you said about the blanket prescriptions just not being the thing, because that is probably true across so many different health, you know, quote-unquote disciplines like nutrition, anything. You know, it's people want these simplistic approaches, you know, don't eat gluten, don't eat this, eat that, et cetera, et cetera, and just with a broad, you know, stroke of the brush, apply it to everybody, and it just doesn't work that way. Everybody is unique, and, you know, we have to, yeah, I like that.
Well, and it's also, I mean, it's important to remember that the human biologically needs, you know, pretty much the same thing. We all need the same thing if we are all at the same place. But when you're having a particular issue, your issue is not about your humanness. Your issue is about your behaviors up until this point. And so you might not have a problem with maybe walking isn't a big deal for you. Maybe you already walk, you know, 10 miles a day, and in which case you come to me and you're like, I have pelvic floor disorder and I jog, you know, I run all this time, what should I do? And it would be really, you need to pull back a little bit because the amount of high loading that you're doing is too much for the human body. So if you took that as like, you know, I went to Katie and she told me for my pelvic disorder that I need to actually add meditation and some relaxation and more kind of mindfulness and restfulness to my day, and you give that to your friend who doesn't do anything, then it starts to look like you end up getting the wrong kind of prescription. So with nutrition and with movement, what you're trying to do is see what you do too much and too little of and balance it out by taking away some of the excess. I mean, we're very much an ecosystem that requires a correct balance of everything. And so we have to, you know, we look at gait patterns, we look at everything, and then go, oh, it's very easy to see from a biomechanical perspective what you're doing too much of and what you're doing too little of, and what would balance that out becomes your prescription, if you will.
Exactly. Well, your website has a lot of great information and videos, and you present all of this very scientific stuff with a great sense of humor, and I really appreciate that. And I encourage everybody to go, you know, whether you're having any issues or not with alignment, like from bunions in your feet to, you know, headaches, go and search your blog for articles and videos and things about that, and take a look at the products that you offer, your book and your DVDs. They're all really good. And, again, your site is alignedandwell.com. Thank you so much, Katie. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. It was nice talking to you.